You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, November 7th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, no longer in the literal, never having been in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times, nor are we in the fashionable dollar lunch district of New York City, but instead, downtown sunny Brooklyn, overlooking massive amounts of commercial construction. It's Casual Friday, folks. I'm still working on a new opening for the program. And joining us, as it is Casual Friday, Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Ostensibly to give me a movie recommendation will be executive producer emeritus of the Majority Report, Josh Horton, in studio, if he can find it. He'll also give us an explanation, hopefully, as to why Scott Walker won so big in Wisconsin. Also on the program today, new jobs report. Somewhat positive, but still the major problems persist. And we certainly saw that reflected in this midterm election. Also on the program today, that town of Denton in Texas, which passed that fracking ban. And on the afternoon show that I was doing over the summer briefly, I interviewed one of the lead activists there. We're going to try and find that interview and replay it in the coming days. But they were immediately sued. Immediately. After the ban went into or was passed. Also, appeals court now finds that marriage equality is not necessarily constitutional. This will send this to the Supreme Court. We will talk about that. And the U.S. Army's way of saying I love you, you can still use the term Negro. Cliff and I will also address the question, Tea Party, was it tamed in this midterm? And, of course, since the midterms are over, folks, you know what that means. We are now in the 2016 presidential elections period. It's only 2 years off. And Ben Carson making waves. Armstrong Williams. Well, that's all I'm going to say. Ben Carson, Armstrong Williams. Can you guys put that together? We will talk about that later in the program. Also, some incredible new reporting about what's going on with Starbucks coffee. Just absolutely stunning. But first off, I want to maybe we should wait for Cliff to play this clip because it probably is a good jumping off point. That's what we're going to do. We will we'll wait for Cliff to play that clip. I just want to remind you that this show is supported. 99.9% of its revenue at this point comes from you folks, its members. And then some of you folks, actually the vast majority of you, are not members. You get the show for free every day. God bless you. But if you want the show to be able to continue and expand and just maintain, frankly, 5 days a week as a free program, sometimes it's four, sometimes 4.5. We need your support. So become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com or just head over to majority.fm. Of course, there are other ways of supporting this program. If you drink coffee, for instance, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% discount, coupon code with the word majority. Get the Majority Report blend. Makes a great gift. And if you buy crap from Amazon, you've got to be using our kickback link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. We'll be right back with Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen, because it's Casual Friday, is the subject of this theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Cliff Schechter joining us for the second time this week. The first time was to preview the midterm elections. The second time is to come on and talk about how much worse it was than we could have ever predicted. Cliff, I don't know how you're doing. This week has been incredibly distressing to me. Well, and I also learned that I can't stay up to 2 o'clock in the morning and have the rest of the week not be destroyed.
Yeah, that's bad. I learned that too. We're old now, Sam. That's the first part. Second of all, though, I want you to know I'm pointing at you right now with a gang sign, so beware.
Oh, yeah?
Have you seen that whole thing?
No. What are you talking
about? I guess not. It's blowing up on Twitter right now. Apparently, the Minneapolis mayor, I believe, in a picture with an African-American man, so right away you know it's scary, was pointing at him with, you know, just doing like a pointer finger, just to joke around, be like, hey, this guy next to me, dressed in like a Santa Claus outfit. And the news reported it, and the police reported it as she was doing a known gang sign. Because, that, you know, when you point your finger and you're standing next to black people, you know, it's racist. Who knows what you're doing? Who knows what code you're doing?
They're claiming that the mayor was actually giving knowingly giving a gang sign?
Yes, that is correct, for pointing her finger. You'll see it under Pointergate. Right now on Twitter, it is we're all having fun with it because what else can you do with the ridiculousness that is our country? I think in a way that what we just talked about sums up the 2014 election.
Yeah, in many respects. But part of it was there's a vacuum. All right, there's two things that I want to use as a point of departure. Okay.
Yep.
Let's. I want to start with just this quote from Marcos. Okay. Because he sums up this the sort of the structural argument, which I think is legit, but it goes like this. In 2004, Republicans won big and Democrats were left trying to figure out what went wrong. In 2006, Democrats won big and they decided everything was fine. Republicans merely shrugged it off as a six-year itch that bedevils parties that hold the White House in a president's last midterm. In 2008, Democrats won big again and Republicans were left fumbling for excuses, but mainly decided it was Bush's fault and an artifact of Obama's historic campaign. In 2010, Republicans won big, so they were validated. All was fine. Democrats were left fumbling. In 2012, Democrats won big, so they decided everything was fine. Demographics and data to the rescue. Republicans decided to rebrand until they decided, F that, no rebranding was needed. Now in 2014, Republicans are validated again in Democrats' own six-year itch elections, and Democrats are scrambling for answers. Here's what the future will look like. In 2016, Democrats will win big on the strength of presidential year turnout. Republicans will realize they have a crap time winning presidential elections, and maybe they should do something about it. In 2018, Republicans will win on the strength of off-year Democratic base apathy, and they'll decide everything is okay after all. And it's going to be brutal because those are the governorships we need for the 2020 redistricting. Republicans will then lock up the House for another decade. Then in 2020, Democrats will win on presidential year turnout and so on and so on. That's the structural dilemma that we have on some level, right?
Do you want to discuss that one first, or would you like to read the second
thing? Let's play the second thing next, okay, so that we can take these two things in their totality, because this is I think the baseline of what went on was a function of that structural dilemma that Marcos sort of puts out there. Basically, that Democrats have trouble getting people to the polls just generally, or there's a general reluctance. Let me put it this way. There's a general reluctance of people in an off-year election to take these elections seriously on the Democratic side. But right, then there's this part of the equation, too, which was summed up, frankly, by The Daily Show. Jordan Klepper, as the correspondent, talking to John Stewart, and this is what he had to say. Play this.
This new ungridlocked GOP, can the GOP follow through on their pledge?
All right, hold on, stop it. Wait a second. Does it sound like that? Okay, well, that's useless. All right, but basically what he says, does it sound okay? Because I can't hear it. Okay.
I can hear it, all right.
All right, let's play it again.
11:27 Eastern Time, the Republicans gained control of the U.S. Senate, and results were almost immediate. The economy now growing at a robust 3.5%. Gas this morning, under $3. A gallon. Look, stock market at record levels. Deficits cut in half. 10 million more Americans have health insurance. And unemployment sub 6% for the first time since we elected Chairman Obama.
Well, wait, hang on a second, Jordan, because the things that you're describing.
Like, even Ebola, John, think about this, which was on the verge of destroying the country under Obama's feckless leadership, has suddenly become a problem for, like, one guy. It's morning in America, John.
Jordan, that is an incredibly impressive list that you ticked off of things that happened under Obama and the Democratic Senate.
Oh, please. John, if Democrats had accomplished all of that, they would have been out there bragging about it for months. It would have been the central message of their campaign instead of their actual message, which was like, I'm quoting this here, we're sorry, don't be mad. We don't like Obama either. We like guns, too. Amen.
Jordan, everything you're describing is exactly how things were before last night.
No, not from where I'm standing. It's like suddenly this country, it's like people are filled with, like, an anticipation, an optimistic expectation. It's like a sense of
hope. It's hope.
Right, yeah, right. But right, more than that, it's as though, like, things are going to be, they're gonna, you know, it's not like they're the same as they once were. They're gonna be different. They're gonna
change. It's hope and change.
Yes.
Hope and change.
Yes.
Right.
You feel it too, John. Hope and change. That's the Republican message.
The Republicans cannot The Republicans cannot claim that as their message.
Yes, they can. Yes, they can. God. The American people, they can. The American people, they're grateful. They've already.
All right. So that's basically it right there is, the Democrats ran on nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's OK. So let's tackle both of those, because I think the one thing that drives me crazy and why I like to think hopefully we're different here, Sam, about so many mainstream pundits is, as I always call it, it's the Norwood rule, which is goes back to that Super Bowl between the Giants and the Buffalo Bills. You may remember 90-91. Where essentially if the kicker ends up missing the kick, the Giants win, and so Buffalo did everything wrong. But if that kick that went just wide had gone in and Buffalo won, then they would have found a million reasons why the Giants did everything wrong and Buffalo did everything right, right, just based on that one thing. And I think that's punditry in Washington. And so I think it's important to sit here and say, you know, there were a number of factors. Look, I don't remember if you predicted, but I thought they were going to hold on to the Senate. It doesn't mean that at the time I thought they had a great message. It doesn't mean I thought the turnout machine they put together would be good enough to get it going and pull them over the top. I thought some candidates would be good enough to win while still thinking there should have been much more to run on.
Right.
So we should be honest, because I'm never going to be Bill Kristol and be like, what? Me wrong? You know what I mean? So I think that's the point. There's numerous factors here. Marcos hits one of them, but it's not just that one. And it's funny because what John Stewart, it fits into that perfectly, because I was going to bring up when you read Marcos's structural analysis, it seemed like, you know, he was saying this is we don't see things changing. This is the foreseeable future. And I think of two times when obviously in recent history, this was very different. Actually, three times. Let's talk about it. One is 98, right, where the Republicans went after Bill Clinton on impeachment. And Democrats came out and told people what they had done for them and said, these guys are trying to stop us with impeachment, right? But in the end, they gained a governor's seat, I believe. They held the Senate even, and they gained three House seats. In 2002, even though it was lies and bullshit, the Republicans came out and said, see, we're protecting you, and we're going to make sure that nobody does this to you again. And everybody was shell-shocked by 9/11. So the people who had a positive message that they were going to do something, even though it was Bush was in office, they kind of beat the usual midterm losses, which again we don't have huge statistical information in the modern media age of what happens during a midterm. So let's be realistic about that too. Everybody wants to generalize everything out, and it can't always be done. Finally, in 2006, where Bush should have lost some seats theoretically, right? The 6-year itch and all that. The Democrats, if you remember, before they really started pushing the message of getting out of Iraq, there hadn't been a wave forming yet. But once they did that, largely part of that was Ned Lamont going after Joe Lieberman in a Democratic primary, and all over with Democrats saying, here's what we will do for you. We will get you out of this terrible war that you don't want to be in, that is wasting our money and getting people killed. And the Democrats turned that into a huge wave. So, and there's other times too, but let's just go with those right now.
All right, well, hold on. Let me just amend 2006 too. The other thing that was operative in 2006, the Iraq War was a huge rallying point for Democrats. But I'm also convinced that because that was an incentive for Democrats to really get out and vote, but they also pushed the corruption of the Republican Party. I mean, remember,
sure,
that's when you had Foley down in Florida, and the whole intern scandal, and
you had what's his name, Mr. Super Lobbyist in D.C. with and, the restaurant,
and the guy who was the head of the Republican congressional campaign committee from upstate New York, surrounding himself with children so that reporters couldn't.
Well, you have that, but it's what's important to say, and is that you need a again, like I feel like we always repeat ourselves here. You know, people react to stories. That's why movies do well. You need a story. You need one that evokes emotion. And in a story, you basically need to have who's the good guy who's going to help you? How are they going to help you? Who's the bad guy who's caused your problems? What are their problems? And how are you going to stop that? And if you don't tell a story, which has been the biggest Obama problem, I think, often, with a lot of his programs, he doesn't tell a story of everything because he doesn't want to be mean. You know, if he'd come in and when he was elected and reminded people what the Republicans had trashed the place, they couldn't handle a hurricane in a major American city, the economy had gone to crap under them. If he'd done all that stuff and said, here's how we're going to help you, you know, oh my God, does healthcare and everything in 2010, in my opinion, go a ton better. Just like, you know, FDR came in 32 and kept telling that story. And in 34, there was a blowout where they won another huge election. So what I'm saying here is you're right. You need a negative message. And there was one in 2006 that was based on they're corrupt. They're trying to privatize your Social Security as part of their corruption. Mm-hmm. They couldn't even handle Katrina. You know, they're appointing people who are corrupt. And here's, we're going to help you. And corruption also, by the way, got us into the Iraq War, right? But we're going to get you out. Here's what we're going to do for you. Besides, you know, here's the reforms. And that's how they're going to always be at an advantage, or at least as our current lineup goes, because older, whiter voters turn out more, wealthier. It's just the way it goes. So there's an upper middle class professional base of Democrats who, you know, that's one of the parts of the Democratic base that turns out. But for other groups of Democrats who are looking at tougher times and don't have a motivation to just turn out, you need to remind them why they're for you. And you need to remind them not just 6 months beforehand. You need to stand up for certain things. You need to have, I hate using the term, but you need to have a brand. People need to know what you stand for. And when your response is after you pass the stimulus and everything, and then you lose in 2010 because you don't tell people a story, and your response is, well, we're going to tighten our belts, and now we're for austerity, and we're going to cut Social Security and Medicare, what the hell do you stand for, and why should people come out and vote for you? Why do they trust you? If the Democrats had built this whole election and based it on policies of the last couple of years and then ran on trying to increase Social Security, trying to increase public spending for education, fighting for new job programs, at least offering them in the Senate, making speeches about them, barnstorming the country, fighting for infrastructure spending that would create jobs, and explained that to people, because not letting it get demonized like the stimulus, which is, oh, we're not going to tell you why it's going to do any good. We're just throwing a bunch of money out there, but you have no idea what it's doing. You don't know that it's for these programs that Republicans are taking credit for at home that are actually creating jobs. If you did that, because as they were saying there, look, and you know, you need to remind people of the positive things you've done, as they were saying on Jon Stewart, absolutely. But when most people feel like, yes, employment's gotten better, but wages haven't gone up and they're still hurting, you can't sit there and not tell them what you're still going to do for them in the future.
Yep.
So it needs to be, here's what we've done for you to dig you out of this Republican mess. Here's where things were in 2008 when I took over. Here's where things are now. Here's what we've proposed to do for you that Republicans are blocking. And not run away from Obamacare, not even call it Obamacare. Here's the Affordable Care Act, which they fought. You know, here I am, Allison Lundgren-Drines in Kentucky. Here's this fantastic program, Connect, that's working so well for you. Here I am, Mark Pryor in Arkansas. Here I am, you know, Begich in Alaska and every other one of the vulnerable candidates. Here's how you've gotten health care. The reason why you don't have $5,000 or whatever more dollars coming out of your pocket is because of us. This is what we've done for you. You know, don't let them just call it Obamacare and scare you away from it. Call it the Affordable Care Act and tell them what it's doing for them and how you fought to pass it, because it's helping them. Tell them how you're going to make sure that wealthy people pay the same tax that everybody else pays on Social Security, so that your Social Security check is going to go up, because that's what we should be doing. It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. And during hard economic times, it's the smart thing to do. And on like that. You need to explain to people, this is why the White House's press shop has driven me crazy. It's why Democrats running away from accomplishments drives me crazy. I mean, you know, to some degree, they're all to blame for this.
Yes,
last thing I'll say, and then, you know, I know I've been talking a lot. Let me let you jump in. But that is how you defeat what is automatically going to be a structural disadvantage for us at every midterm. That's the way. Republicans don't need to do as much. Sure, they need to give a positive program somewhat, but their people are already going to turn out because they're angry old codgers. And that's what you're looking at.
And let me say this, is that I'm not even convinced that, and though I wholeheartedly agree with what you're talking about, and I think for, you know, quite a while we were saying, I mean, as early as late, I can't even tell, I'm exhausted from all of this. In March, you know, I was on Hayes saying, like, they should run on expanding Social Security just so they have something to run on. And they abandoned the wealth inequality argument, which I think was very problematic. Like I said on the program a couple of days ago, you don't even necessarily have to have a great answer for a problem, but clearly by not acknowledging that there is a problem that most people are going through. You know, when you acknowledge the problem, and Josh Orton is in the office, and we will talk about this because I remember we talked about it then back in the day. But President Obama, when he was candidate Obama, the way that he won Iowa, or at least one of the ways in which he won Iowa, was to go in there and say, there's a crisis in Social Security. Now, I disagreed with that characterization, but it activated the lizard brains of old people. Good for him in that regard, and got them to vote, because there is a sense that if you acknowledge a problem that you're going to do something about it. I mean, and you've got people out there who, and we've got good jobs numbers this month ostensibly, but again, the underlying problems with the job market are still there, and not acknowledging that I think came back to haunt people.
Well, that's always been a problem. It's the running away. It's not acknowledging.
We
need to do better, but here's what we're doing. And again, I think this is all important, because I think this is why, again, you know, the
let me finish one more point. Even if this had only mitigated the loss slightly, like it was, every person across the board still lost. Maybe they would have lost by a couple of points less, whatever. It wouldn't have fundamentally changed things. At the very least, you're building a long-term narrative, which is sorely lacking. I mean, there is and it could very well be just that we don't have a Democratic Party that fundamentally embraces these things. But gosh, guys, get cynical. And at the very least, sell it.
No, exactly. And we need to just – that's why I sort of started off with what I started off with, is that you and I talked about this for months. Now, I'll admit, I still thought they were going to be able to hold on, which some of them were able to. I mean, few of them came really close. I mean, Mark Begich, who won't, I don't think, through the votes they have left, be able to get enough votes. And Kay Hagan, who I think in some other ways, by making education spending a big issue she ran on, they helped their cause. And I think it made things closer than they would have otherwise been. So I'm not saying that there was none of that, but it was disparate. It was different messages coming from different places, and you didn't have an overall overarching message. What they did, obviously, you did,
and that is just that. Like, we're running away from anything that has really happened.
But I think, you know, yes. And
that was the only overall message.
No, that was a huge problem. And it's not to say, look, Bruce Braley had some problems because he was a bad candidate. Yep. There are individual, Gene Shaheen still pulled out New Hampshire, right? What I can't stand, again, I hope I'm making myself clear here, is pundits who say one thing is going on, then the results happen, and it's different than they thought, and the next day they're saying, oh, something totally different is going on, without acknowledging that they were saying something else before, all right? I still thought that there was enough going on, that Democrats, they had good enough candidates and whatever to hold the House. But even when I thought that, you and I were still having these discussions that it was crazy that they were not talking about income inequality,
right,
that they weren't talking about, that most of them were not talking about raising Social Security, that they were not making it clear what they were going to do, that they were Democrats, that this is what they stood for, this is what we've always stood for. And those, obviously, some of that's broader party problems. Again, you know, I mean, look at who lost. Right. I mean, I love my friend Howie Klein, who writes it Down with Tyranny, who labeled 2010 the great blue dog apocalypse.
Yep.
So now he's calling 2014 the great blue dog apocalypse, too. They just lost. I mean, one or two of them retired. And Mike Michaud, who's clearly one of the more liberal blue dogs, but nonetheless was one and got a lot more liberal for his gubernatorial run, a lot more progressive. You know, he lost, too, in that governor's race. And, of course, Elliot Cutler was part. I mean, there, again, many factors in all of these. But overall, that's where we lost most of our seats, were blue dogs and New Democrats. The Blue Dogs caucus, which was at 19, has now fallen to about 10.
Well, that's the story with Warner, right, in Virginia. Is that,
that's where I was going to get to next, completely... which is go to your third way page.
Yeah.
By the way, everybody, I know you may feel icky doing it, but go to the third way page and look at who their co-chairs are on the third way page. You'll see Mark Udall there, who had to be brought, you know, almost kicking and screaming to saying, I won't cut Social Security, because he'd been a grand bargain guy for a long time, but never came out for raising it. Kay Hagan is a second co-chair, and Gene Shaheen is third. Now, we're talking about five co-chairs here. And you know, two of the three of them lost, and one of them almost lost to a guy moving up from
Massachusetts. I'm not convinced that Shaheen, if she's running against a politician from New Hampshire, if she doesn't win, I mean, Scott Brown, all the polling reports, honestly, the exit polls on him said that, like, the number one factor was just that people felt like he'd, he was, you know,
he started casually crossing the border, right?
And had no real interest in New Hampshire, except for that was where he could run against somebody.
And he kept screwing it up. I mean, in a debate, they asked him about a part of New Hampshire. He didn't know where the hell, I mean, he knew where it was. He didn't know what the hell was going on there, and he had to come back later with a better answer. You know, he still had his place of business listed as Massachusetts, which is hysterical. You know, I mean, there were a number of things that kept connecting him back to Massachusetts, you know, which he wasn't able to get away with.
And speaking now, about gubernatorial races in as well, remember that Alison Schwartz lost the Pennsylvania government.
That's another co-chair.
Yep.
Of the, and she stepped
down. She lost
down.
The primary because
so if you
of
look at it,
her relationship and, with that and the chain CPI. And
now Mark Warner may not have been a co-chair, I looked at the page, but clearly he has to be a member of Third Way. And at this point, he may be the most conservative senator left. I mean, the caucus, frankly, with who they lost.
Joe Manchin.
I mean, I'm not happy because it's a smaller caucus and we don't have a majority, but losing Kay Hagan, Mark Pryor, if I don't want to lose Mary Landrieu, but if we do, at this point, Mark Warner is probably on the rightward end of that caucus. He's a guy who's called himself a radical centrist. His biggest thing he talks about all the time is a grand bargain, is cutting entitlements. He's you know, opposes raising taxes on wealthy people. I mean, there's almost no way that he's a populist. He bought into all of this crap, and look at what happened. Out of nowhere, a guy whose name is literally part of the name of one of the biggest lobbying firms right next door in D.C. almost beat him.
Yep.
I mean, you know, that's what we're talking about here, right? So, I mean, look at what happened to those. And again, there are some other cases where there were some more progressive people who lost again. I'm not saying that this is – there's no one over one formula, but there are some very clear signals about when Democrats win and how they win versus when they lose and how they lose. And if you can't look at Mark Warner, Mark Pryor, you know, and look at Kay Hagan and people like that, and then look at all, you know, in the end, Braley may have lost, but he made a couple of serious personal mistakes and was running against, sadly, a very talented opponent, even though she's crazy, politically talented. But look at Al Franken and Jeff Merkley, who originally, you remember, both of those guys in 08 barely won. I mean, Franken didn't win for 6 months until they counted it all. Merkley won barely also. They both had won in landslides this time and didn't have to worry the entire time, even though they had initially been listed as being vulnerable, and they were both in purple states. Why? Because neither of them have ever been shy about being progressive. When I see either of their names in the news, it inevitably is about them talking about something they've done that is progressive. I mean, that's just the way it is, you know? Why in 2006... even though it was an election where a lot of Democrats won and pulled it out, but a bunch of them pulled it out very closely, why in Ohio, a quintessential swing state, does current Senator Sherrod Brennan beat the hell out of Mike DeWine by 12 points?
Yep.
Because people knew what he was for. He was talking against trade deals already for years. He had done that as a congressman. All right. This is what he was known for. And so I'm saying, you know, the party, I mean, it definitely disadvantages Democrats that the party overall is, you know, in some way is so feckless because they will not, you know, set a 6 points out and say, this is what we are for. And if you're not for this, you better make it clear you're not for this, because this is de facto what our party stands for. It's not a debate over Social Security. It's, you know, this is what we stand for. And if you're different, you better make your own case.
This is what really struck me, too, in that Merkley race, is that not only did he win, Democrats outnumbered Republicans by even more than they did in 2008. That's a presidential election, right? I mean, that's stunning. That is perhaps one of the most telling stats that is out there. The idea that he pushed turnout that much more, I think, is pretty amazing. I mean, Merkley's opponent was horrible, but that does not account for more Democrats coming out, right?
That's right.
I mean, that is stunning.
Yeah, but, you know, their opponent was horrible, but, you know, Joni Ernst was talented, but she said some stupid things here and there. You know, Cory Gardner got called out for lying in a debate. I mean, there are some Republicans. Look, Mitch McConnell made a number of unbelievable mistakes. I mean, he went into part of Eastern Kentucky and said, it's not my responsibility to bring jobs here. You know, he got up a week before the election and talked about privatizing how he'd been happy to work on privatizing Social Security. It's not like he didn't make any gaffes.
Well,
he did.
It's tough to capitalize on those narratives, I think. I mean, on those on those gaps when you haven't built the proper narrative.
That's what we're saying, is that when if those gaps fit into the narrative is, we're going to make your life better. Here's what we've done already. We've brought the country back from where you guys took it. You had unified government, you, Mitch McConnell, as part worked with the Bush administration to destroy our economy, to bring it down. All right, you were there for Katrina. You were there for Iraq. I wasn't there. You're the one who screwed everything up. Now I'm going to join this movement that's making things better. But I think that would have held Democrats, again, though, a lot of blame. Sorry, still, you know, I understand. And again, I'm no fan of Harry Reid, to be honest with you, after he undermined Rick Wyland in South Dakota. But I understand why Reid's people are so angry at Obama and that stuff spilled out, because in the end, a lot of what his chief of staff is saying is correct. I mean, you know, they were undermined a number of times. And it's very difficult to come back from that when the overall brand of your party, you know, the guy at the top is screwing around with maybe cutting Social Security and is in love with charter schools and is somebody who said they were going to do a number of things like renegotiate trade deals but never even attempted to do it. And, you know, and we can go on and on and on. They won't make their case to the public by telling the public who the bad guys are and who the good guys are in this equation and who screwed things up and who's making things better, because he doesn't want to say mean things about the other guys and still thinks that in some part of his brain that I don't understand, that maybe they'll sit down with me and make a good deal.
All right. Well, all right. We've had our opportunity to vent now. Let's talk a little bit about where we're going. I mean, honestly, it's like, you know, we need to get this out of our system. But the real issue now is it is what it is. And,
no, I know. But I think we're having a logical conversation. I mean, yes, I'm talking in a tone. But at the same time, I think all this stuff is important for the future, because it's not just, I mean, really what we fail to do is what we have to do. It's
and
not
I do
over.
Think I do think that there is a greater sort of awareness in the you know, the liberal centrist press on some level of this dynamic. I mean, I think there is a little bit. I mean, a little bit. But let's talk a little bit. I want to touch on a little bit about what President Obama came out. He gave a 70-minute press conference yesterday or Wednesday, I guess it was. And he said multiple times he's going ahead with the executive action on immigration reform, which – give me your take on this. I mean, look, I'm very worried about, and we've talked about this for a long time, in terms of the Senate, and you know, Josh and I are going to talk a little bit about the governor's races, which is maybe more devastating even than the loss of the Senate long term.
I think it is, because clearly right now there are bad things we've talked about that can be done in the Senate, but also, you know, to hold on to seats for the, depending on how many seats we have, with some of those Republican elections coming up in 2016 that will be tough for them, you can see getting a Mark Kirk or somebody to vote for some of your judges and other people, because he's going to have to try to win in Illinois in a presidential year, right? So there we've already discussed this. There's some bad aspects on the federal level. There's no doubt. Let's not sugarcoat it. At the same time, I think there are things that potentially can get done, and the Senate was already going to be bad anyhow, whereas the states, I think, is even more devastating, because in the end, we now still have a number of key important states being led by people that essentially are just either somewhat good at papering over their lunacy, like Scott Walker and Snyder in Michigan, and frankly Kasich here in Ohio, which is a whole other what went down here. But on top of that, I mean, to me, the two of the night that just I couldn't get over is Rick Scott winning re-election and frickin' lunatic LePage. I mean, those two people, I mean, it's not even like Scott Walker is a bad guy. Snyder, Kasich, these are all people who I don't believe their politics. I don't believe they're honest. But those two guys, you know, Scott and LePage are basically borderline criminals. I mean, Scott basically was, in terms of the government going after him for what his previous job was. And LePage, as you and I talked about on the show, basically, you know, he spends every other week, is it, hanging out with domestic terrorists? I don't remember.
He stopped after the intervention.
Okay, well, that was nice of him. I mean, these are people that are embarrassing. They're Michelle Bachmann-esque, but, you know, people like that who are, they're as bad as any unbelievably embarrassing congressman, but they're running a whole state. And that's just amazing to me.
that they were able to hold on.
So let's get back to what do you think we're going to see? I mean, I was happy to see Obama come out and say, and it occurs to me that, you know, it's one of two things that I interpret from the president coming out and making such a point about immigration reform. One, that he's thinking, they're thinking in the White House, like, this is the Hail Mary. We do this, and it is going to be the biggest distraction possible. It is like waving, a ball of string in front of, like, a little kitty cat.
Right.
The Republicans are going to go bat crap crazy over this if he does it.
Yep.
It makes it look like he's offering the opportunity for them to do reform. They won't take it. There's obviously going to be, there's at least some exit poll data out there that shows that him not doing this may have hurt at least Udall and others. But
I'm sure it hurt some of our people in Nevada, too. And I mean, we got crushed in Nevada.
If he does this, if he does the executive action, let's say in November or December, how many weeks later will it take for the articles of impeachment to
Well, come out? I was going to say, you should be daring them to impeach you.
That's what he's doing,
because,
isn't it?
Because the more sane people – well, I think he is, and I'll give him credit for that the other day. He sounded much more defiant, certainly, than after 2010. You know, we got thumped and, you know, we'll have to rethink things. No. You know, you were still elected president twice. They still obstructed you the entire time. They may have a high water point in the House, but they don't have the Senate. It's not like they have 60 votes in the Senate or something. You know, it comes. You keep doing, and at least it seemed to me he said some of these things, and said that he was going to, I'm also talking about the 2/3 of people. I'm going to look. You know, I don't know the exact phrase he used, but the 2/3 of people who didn't bother to vote, which seemed to me to be implying there's a reason they didn't vote. They didn't vote Republican either, right?
Well, at least there's some defiance there. I mean, you know,
there was.
Because there's a million other responses I can have imagined that Obama could have come out and said, I've heard the people, and now the Republicans are going to have to govern, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, but it's basically the same response he gave after. I don't know what it was.
But I would be sitting there and saying, you know, this is Sun Tzu time. You know what I mean? I mean, this is art of war time. You need to sit there and say, right now, we have, in addition to the people that everyone's heard of, you know, because of this election, like Joni Ernst and Cory Gardner, they maybe haven't heard as much about Tom Cotton because that race has been off the radar for a while. They almost definitely haven't heard as much about maybe the biggest lunatic of the batch, Ben Sasse, who won in Nebraska, who, you know, there was no real race there, and he is freaking nuts. So these four people I named, I'm sure there are others, are every bit as bad as Ted Cruz, if not worse. You can divide that caucus up. You remember what happened with the
House?
That's
what he did. He basically threw a live grenade into the Republican caucus.
But,
I mean,
but
if he had come out and said, like,
one part
incidentally,
of it.
I want you all to know, and I wasn't going to say anything about this, but Speaker Bonaire is actually a secret Democrat. We spend weekends together. And
we golf together. Everybody
we golf
knows
together.
Know, right?
And I wasn't going to say anything, but I shouldn't have let that out. Or if he had said something like, I'm really terrified of Senator Cruz.
Can you imagine if it was you and me, how much fun we would have doing it? Like, I would sit there and think of ways to say things and policies to come up with just to get the Senate to blow up.
Or if he just came out and said, like, look, I just want you to know that I got the election results and I was at the mosque praying to, oh my God, did I say that?
That would be awesome. look, McConnell went after his presidency and frankly damaged it in a pretty serious way. I mean, a lot of it I still blame him because he allowed it to happen and didn't see this somehow. But okay, done is done. But now McConnell got what he wanted, right? He's Senate Majority Leader. Man, why don't you screw up his Senate majority ship, or whatever you call it, and just let him have the fun thing Ted Cruz stand up and call him an idiot, you know? I mean, I would pass as many gay-friendly things as possible. Maybe I'd officiate a couple of gay weddings
right.
So Ted Cruz blows up and tries to pass that constitutional amendment he wants to pass so badly on gay. I mean, get them to just fight amongst themselves on the most divisive topics.
Well, that's this immigration thing, I think, is going to do it. I mean,
doing it by executive action
seems to me to be – not only good policy, but great politics. And
I agree. But I would do it with other things, too. Get them fighting on all – don't unite them on things they all agree with, on certain tax measures and whatever. Divide them.
Right. Take them apart on really on social issues, a lot of which they hate, you know, they're fighting amongst themselves on.
Right.
And I would.
A White House program to hand out free contraceptives, I think.
Now you're thinking. So, you know, we're basically going to go and screw with that and wedge these different groups away from them. That's what I would do. I'd go across the country. I'd perform gay marriages. That's what I would do.
Well, Cliff Schechter, that avenue is still open to you. And maybe
if I could, I would.
Dude, you can become a justice of the peace? What is it? What am I thinking of? The
communist?
No, what's that thing where you can become basically a guy?
Drug dealer?
Is it a justice of the peace? No. He gives you the notary, a notary. Republic.
Yeah, justice of the peace, I think, is if you're a policeman.
Is that a notary republic?
Notary public. I can't remember what it is.
I just have one last thing to say. Do we have like just a minute or two?
Of course.
Okay, so just so people know and understand the reach of this program, if you don't get it enough, about 2 weeks ago, here I am. I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio. I go out to this event, great event, by the way, because I sit on the board of a group here, which is I'm really proud of, a hugely important group called the Ohio Innocence Project, which is what we do is we try to get people out of prison who've been falsely put in prison, get them DNA testing, and all that kind of stuff. And we were having our yearly gala to raise money. So I show up there, you know, and of this project, and some of the people who've been freed are there to speak. I mean, it was really fantastic. And somebody walks up to me, this guy, hopefully he's listening right now, his name is Levi Daly, who's a lawyer in Northern Kentucky, and he's like, "You're Cliff Schechter from the Majority Report." And that is how he knew me. It's nothing else I've ever done in life. He knew me because of the Majority Report, because he listens. So anytime anybody out there thinks to themselves, you know, maybe I'm alone in my bunker listening to this, you are not.
There are other people in their bunkers.
In their bunkers, too. You are one of millions out there.
Thousands of bunkers across the country.
Built for just this experience, just for the experience of hearing Sam Cedar. So
indeed.
Just so everybody knows, you're in good company here on this show. And I felt...
Leads us to our latest sponsor, freeze-dried food.
It was a funny experience, so it was kind of cool. In any case, thank you as always.
Cliffy,
Sam.
Always a pleasure. I wish it was under better circumstances, but
We get right back up and we beat their asses, and there's no reason why we can't get back at it and do the things we failed to do.
Indeed. So. All right, Cliff Schechter, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you. Take care.
Talk to you next week. All right, folks, coming up in just a moment, we're going to be joined by Josh Orton, who's going to give us a perspective on what took place in Wisconsin and also ostensibly a movie recommendation and your general thoughts. And I'm saying your because I'm actually looking at Josh. He's the first in-studio guest we have in our new studio. Hopefully not the last, but possibly the last. We'll see how it goes. With that said, and we also have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song, we will probably do a Freebie Friday. But first, let's do this sound clip because it's been burning a hole in my skull. I don't know if you remember, from back in the early days of the Obama administration, there was a pastor of the Atla Church in Harlem who was a semi-regular, I believe, on Fox News. Because he was exposing President Obama as a Allah-praising sodomite. And to have an African-American preacher on Fox News criticizing the president was just too rich for them. Well, he's back in the news again. Apparently, he has, if not broken a story, certainly amplified it. This is... quite a public service. Here is Pastor James David Manning of the Atla Church in Harlem. Was this just from a couple of days ago?
Yes.
Okay. And
late breaking
stuff. Here he is. I guess it's part of one of his sermons or just
I think he also has
service?
A YouTube podcast
okay.
type of show.
Let's play this clip.
the sodomites were outside of our church protesting. So we went out and took a look, and they were. And they had a big bucket of Starbucks coffee and all kind of other Starbucks paraphernalia with them. And they were all shouting, "Stop the hate now." They said that this church is a hate church and that I'm a hate preacher. But you remember that last week we appeared in several major online news services, Huffington Post being a major one, The Inquisitor being another. What else? Gay Star News, I think, was one. And I don't, it was just several papers wrote articles about us because we had stated that Starbucks is ground zero for Ebola. And we pointed up how these homosexual sodomite persons, such as Dr. Craig Spencer, who lives right here in the Harlem area, who is a sodomite, that they frequent, that Starbucks is a place where these types frequent and a lot of body fluids are exchanged there. And Ebola, but the thing that I was not aware of is that there had been some information that had been released, and the Inquisitor News online news service carried this as a major story the week before, that what Starbucks was doing is that they were taking specimens of male semen and they were putting it in the blends of their lattes. Now, this is the absolute truth. It's right there. You can see it right there in Inquisitor Online Services. It was a big article about an investigation into Starbucks using male semen and putting it into the blends of coffees that they sell. I mean, can you imagine it? And I believe that they were doing that. You know,
Now, folks, I don't know if we need to comment on this, but before we do, I want to remind you that our sponsor is JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can get the Majority Report blend with or without semen. In fact, most of their blends are almost 100% guaranteed to not mix in with semen because, of course, you would have to do that at home to make your latte. Can you just imagine what his congregation says? Very good on Ebola sources. Not so great on the coffee selections. Have we got word back from Starbucks as to whether or not this is also the case with even the soy lattes, or is this just the?
Wouldn't that sort of be redundant?
The soy latte.
To get the soy latte with if you're.
I thought that's sodomites. The way that you actually deal with the problems with soy.
Oh, is it the sodomite semen overcomes the soy?
Well, doesn't a lot of soy supposedly give you too much estrogen, and then you balance it out with the. I don't know. I don't know the science behind this, but...
It's definitely used in the lattes. That's the best part of that clip. When I heard lattes...
Should we come up with new Starbucks coffee names?
I also just think, like, I don't go to Starbucks much, but every... like Starbucks
anymore.
Anymore. Now I'm never going to go, right? But, like...
didn't know this, though?
No.
I mean, I always get the extra semen blend in my...
Why didn't you ever give me the information?
I'm sorry.
Man? No, but it's like body fluids being exchanged at Starbucks is one of the most dreary, bleak places on the planet. It's
not like, my Starbucks.
It's like you're at...
Ebola's out of control at Starbucks. I mean, I would think that speaks for itself. I mean,
like how they had a bucket of Starbucks coffee. That's just...
let's hope he doesn't go to Dairy Queen.
That's right.
Actually, seriously, you probably shouldn't go there.
Oh my God! All right, let's
see. Like Dairy Queen people, no, like we actually do that. Like, seriously,
there's some. I mean, that's he read it on a website, so it's probably true. Although, you know, I'm a little suspicious just because he didn't cite where the whole Ebola at Starbucks was. I'm much more comfortable with the whole semen story than the Ebola transfer story because he didn't cite a source for that one. It also sounds like, frankly, that Harlem is ground zero for Ebola, and I want to know what the heck is going on up there.
The doctor doesn't even live in Harlem. He couldn't even get that right.
He doesn't live in Harlem?
No, he lives in Brooklyn.
No, he doesn't.
No, he lives in Harlem. He was going to Brooklyn.
What are you going to tell us now,
Matt? Oh,
you can't get semen in your Starbucks? Wow.
And apparently, Mr. Binder had too much semen in his latte and couldn't get the basic facts of the Ebola story correctly.
Yeah. Maybe you should spend less time doing your Gamergate videos.
More time get following
and, well,
Christ.
The article he talks about is one of those like clickbaity, like, were semen samples really found in Starbucks drinks nationwide? And initiating then, an FDA
what was
investigation?
The answer? No.
Let me look.
Answer, no.
And the answer? Snopes even has something about it. That's how. I mean, when you're,
I have a feeling that the pastor does not strike me as the type of guy who's very rigorous in checking if his information is an urban legend.
I would just love to be friends with him on Facebook and watch remember when those Facebook notices went around where people would put like, I hereby under some convention that doesn't exist, like copyright all of my personal information on Facebook or something.
All right, let's play. We got a Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Let's play that song. Do we have it?
We do.
Let's play that song right now. What is the name of this song?
Hold on, I'm pulling it up. Here we go. It is called Friggin' Midterm Election Blues
by Jimmy Reefer Cake. Although I'm surprised. Let me just make a prediction here that, I mean, you had at least three marijuana referendums pass. So I'm surprised that it's – that the title is that – but let's go. Let's hear it.
One, two, three. I got me a case of the midterm election blues. Every four goddamn years, it seems, all the liberals lose. I got a feeling so down, and it's filling me with rage. 'Cause two times in a goddamn row, we elected Paula Page. The page still holds controller. Is it 'cause of the bears or the Ebola? I wish I could wipe the smile out the faces of him and all his rich donors. I hate to say I told you so, as if I know more than you. But when it comes to marijuana, people deserve to hear the truth. When it comes to these independents, like Cutler and Angus King, they're hurting me so bad now. All I can do is sing. Every four goddamn years, it seems all the liberals lose. I got me a case of the friggin' midterm friggin' election blues.
There you go.
Jimmy very upset that Paula Page won.
Yes, and I don't blame him. Now,
something more important to him than marijuana.
The irony is that actually most of the people who lost, not exactly liberals. Some of the Democrats lost, but I wouldn't call, you know, Mary Landrieu or, well, she hasn't, I guess, technically lost, but I wouldn't call a lot, you know, Mark Pryor a liberal. He was a Democrat. And
he didn't even go fully for raising the minimum wage. So as to
he
not
was
offend
sort of,
Walmart.
He was sort I mean, of was... outflanked on the left by Tom Cotton on that. Even though Tom Cotton is a
he also does
rabid
a great
reaction.
Job of reading teleprompters in his ads. I don't know if you ever saw this. There's a great Mark Pryor ad where he's talking about the Bible, and it just sort of like the Bible is how I form my life. His eyes are completely off center.
Huh.
It's pretty funny.
All right, so let's welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen, the Majority Report producer emeritus. Here, take what's that?
Executive producer emeritus,
Josh Orton, our first in guest, first in studio guest, from the hinterlands in Wisconsin. Josh, let's start there. WTF, Scott Walker again, dude?
Yeah, you know, it was. This is Wisconsin reflects the country a lot in midterm versus presidential election years. There are just two electorates voting in Wisconsin. One votes in the midterms, and one votes in the presidential. And there's, you know, there's a certain number, hundreds of thousands more people that always vote in presidentials. And look, Scott Walker's margin in the recall is about 7%. It was down to 5% victory this time. But, you know, there has to be some soul searching if we're going to talk about changing that. And, you know, we also have to question whether or not it's a smart idea generally, I think. And I'm not proposing this in Wisconsin, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about is why do we have governors elected in years where we don't have a presidential election? I mean, if we have if the most people turn out in presidential years, it seems like that would be the time to have the highest state constitutional offices also be elected. It doesn't really make sense.
Yes, of course. And it doesn't make sense that we have voting on Tuesdays. But, Josh, come on. I mean, let's get to the point here. I don't know. Don't skirt away from this.
Well, no. I
agree with you. No, we need all sorts of types of election reform.
But I think that there's some – I mean, obviously we're talking about the policy stuff and the ideological stuff for Democratic and progressive candidates. But, you know, the structural stuff is just as important because in midterms you see the most affluent
How would you go about changing that? Which governor would say, I've got an office, I'm just going to take a two-year
– and a lot of times it would require a state constitutional amendment. But, you know, when you look at – this is you have a time when – when you have elections where – mostly the most affluent vote, and that's a problem because, you know, you're just, you know, the notion that there are a whole swaths of people who are in communities that are underserved are not voting, you have to think that, well, maybe that's beyond just a messaging problem.
Yeah, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, why if it's beyond a messaging problem, then why do they come out more during a presidential election?
Well, I think it's because there's more. First of all, there's more money in the infrastructure for turnout. This is a much longer. This is almost like a 2-year campaign at this point for president. And there's a lot of money to sort of build a big organizational and data and turnout.
We had $4 billion in this election, and I suppose I don't know how much was in the 2012. How much was in the 2012 election? Probably what, like six?
Yeah, it was a lot.
Okay, I mean, but still.
I'm not saying it's the only reason that governors like Walker won. I'm just saying that I think
my point is that if people get the idea that it's important for them to come out and vote for the president, maybe they can get the idea that it's also important for them to come out and vote for their governor.
Yeah, I think I think there's a lot of solutions, but that's just one of the things that I think hasn't been talked a lot about is that, you know, we've got a really big, and I think this, you know, it ties right back into the voter ID movements of voter suppression. You know, we have a real structural problem when it comes to who votes and how easy it is to vote and who turns out.
So now Scott Walker running for president in 2016, right? I mean, that was basically it. I mean, that was the
look. You know, Scott Walker's is sort of an.
How mad is how? Do you think he called Chris Christie, and just said, "Ha ha." Chris Christie wouldn't give him money, and then Sheldon Adelson came in for the rest.
You know, I don't think he has to. You know, Scott Walker is an interesting fellow. You know, he's been running for basically president of the United States since he was in college. And you know, he's
just
never
like Obama.
He's never really had, you know, any private, you know, he's never really done anything else. And he also considers himself, if you talk to reporters in Wisconsin, they'll tell you that he considers himself the best political strategist in the state. You know, he's a political micromanager. And if you don't think that Scott Walker has always been running for president, you don't know Scott Walker. He's going to make the transition.
Is he a secret Muslim too?
Almost immediately. No, although there was an interesting story towards the end of the cycle. You know, Scott Walker has this very strange bald spot that's sort of like growing from back to front. It's
interesting.
It's strange. And not to say that there's something fishy in of that, just that.
You're saying he's wearing some type of Muslim headpiece?
That... No, although it might look okay. It might look a little more telegenic. He came out and said, well, I know people are joking about this. The reason I have a bald spot is because my wife was asking me to do something in the kitchen, and I lifted my head up, and I banged my head on a kitchen cabinet door, and there was a small scar, and that's why I have a bald spot in the back of my head, even though it's been growing over the last several years. It was just sort of – he's just an odd character. Like, he's not – there is – you know, this is obviously not of substance to his re-election. He's just a strange cat.
That is a weird story. Like, what? Be more explicit. Like, what are we to get? He just saying that he sort of is compulsive lying, or is that he's just sort of like oddly
self-conscious? Well, it's one of these weird stories where it's just like anybody who's covered him and sort of watched him over the years, it's like, well, that it just doesn't make any sense. And there was not really any irony in him.
Maybe he doesn't know that his bald spot's been growing.
Well,
I mean, it's possible.
It's possible.
Now, what's happening with all the John Doe investigations? Is that over? Is that behind him now?
I wouldn't put money on it going any further. I think the interesting thing about what happened here is that there's a couple problems with this, and we can unpack it for a second. At the base of it, there are two things involving Scott Walker's sort of alleged criminality. One is his time from when he was
county executive,
and basically having his employees do his political work on state time. And the other interesting thing that has sort of come out is the investigation into political coordination laws in Wisconsin, which is basically campaign finance law separating a campaign from the outside groups doing the work. And there's problems with both. And the Republicans have done a really good job, and his allies, in basically saying, well, if we did violate the letter of the campaign finance statute, it really shouldn't exist in the first place. You're criminalizing politics. So they're really going after both, and then they went after the DAs who were prosecuting him. You know, they have done an excellent job at politicizing every single fight, and I'm not sure I just don't think it's going to go anywhere else.
Let's talk a little bit about money in politics, because there was a big push by Lawrence Lessig on the Mayday PAC. We had him on this program, I think, at least once or twice to talk about it. They had some very high-profile, I guess, infusions of cash. Rick Weiland was one. But they endorsed, I don't know if it was a half a dozen or a little bit more candidates, and gave them money. Big money, ostensibly, because these people supported some type of campaign finance reform. This project was going to be sort of the test case, so they go out and raise even more money in the 2016 election to, again, promote this, to get a critical mass of candidates in office who were going to push for some type of maybe publicly financed campaigns, et cetera. The long and short of it is every single person that they endorsed, except for Walter Jones, who is a more or less perennial Republican winner, lost, in some cases big time. And what, you know, and I've seen stories that have ranged from he's not so great in terms of political strategizing, they picked the wrong candidates, but, you know, I mean,
you know, it's interesting. I just think, look, this kind of stuff, taking on a project like this, is incredibly hard. And, you know, it seems stupid to say this, but political strategy, and if you're going to start an organization and choose races to win, and then at the end of it say, these people won these races because of what we did and because of what we talked about, is an extremely difficult endeavor. And I think that one of the, you know, I think that there is at least some analogy to when we saw this organization Forward Us, the sort of Zuckerberg kind of front group that was designed to sort of throw all this money to support comprehensive immigration reform. And they had sort of a Democratic group with a bland name, and a Republican group with a bland name. And they had all of these Silicon execs, including, I think, Steve Ballmer, and, you know, all of these sort of huge billionaires funding this thing. And out of the gate last year early, one of the things that they did with this sort of Republican front group that had, like, you know, Americans for America or something like that, is they ran, you know, or they ran ads in support of Lindsey Graham, because ostensibly they needed Lindsey Graham's, you know, they wanted him to win the primary, they wanted him to be reelected because they needed him as a Republican on immigration stuff. And so they ran an ad to support Lindsey Graham based on the fact that he supports Keystone. Which, of course, has nothing to do with immigration reform. Right. It has nothing to do with the interests of the people funding the organization. And it was sort of this too cute by half. It's like, oh, what we'll do is we'll run an ad in his favor on something else. And it'll be, you know, it's like almost, they were trying to be sort of cute about it. And look, you can't just come into this stuff and assume that, you know.
And it basically tanked the whole project.
Not only tanked the whole project, but, you know, our organization and other organizations came out and said, you know, we're pulling our business from Facebook until they sort of cut the stuff out. It's like, it's fine if you want to run ads, for or against immigration reform. That makes sense. Like, talk about what you want to talk about. But the sort of notion that, well, we need to sort of.
And do a bank shot type of thing.
Double bank shot to support, you know, Republicans on an issue that is not even related. And I think there was some of that. You see some of that with May Day. There was that organization that.
They supported an organization in New Hampshire in the primary that was supporting their candidate. And it was unclear that the money was actually ending up in support of. Not just campaign finance reform, but, you know, directly with that candidate as opposed
but
to the
But they certainly worked with the organization.
Right.
And the organization was a pretty far.
That was one of their mistakes, but that was not the sort of. I mean, if we were saying today, hey, they were 6 out of 6 or they were 5 out of 6 in their things, sure. People would not be talking about
but
that.
But I think it goes to a larger point of, you know. The goal, it's
I think people who are involved with tech have a slight overestimation of how disruptive they can
be. Well, and I think it goes back to some of what you were talking about with Cliff, which is that there has to be a story that's told, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the big problems with money in politics is in order for this kind of an effort to work, you really have to exact a lot of political leverage, and you have to, if you win, you have to be able to look back and credibly say, these guys won because they were on the right side of this issue and because we supported them. You need candidates to look, because in the future you want candidates to look back at that and say, you know, it really helped for these guys to be on the right side of the stuff.
Right.
And so maybe I should do that too. And, you know, I think one of the problems is there are not really a lot of money in politics champions. And especially for some of the Republicans, you know, it's a second or third or fourth tier issue with these candidates. You know, they may fill out a questionnaire agreeing with something, but they're not campaigning on it.
Right.
And, you know, I think the one example that could have been a model that I think where that did happen was, remember a few years ago in the New York State Senate, the State Senate race, Cece, what's her last name? I can't remember her last name. But for Friends of Democracy, which is Jonathan Soros' group, I think, went into that race and actually made it a referendum on Citizens United and successfully did that. Mm. And I think that's, you know, we can look at that race as a possible example, but for these kind of races, I think it's going to be a while before we figure out how to run congressional races or statewide races at a referendum on money in politics.
Yeah, I mean it and this was obviously a huge you know, a tough election to be running this in. I mean.
And also, I think that, you know, look, I think they got a lot of early good early press coverage about the effort. You know, but, you know, I had some concerns about where some of the money was coming from because, you know, this they were taking unlimited contributions.
Right.
And from.
And we should say, remind people that you are the political director, and I don't know if you hold another position at Progressives United, which is. It's a Russ Feingold founded organization.
Yeah, it deals with money and politics and basically and corporate influence generally. And one of the things we raised with the Forward Us campaign I talked about last year is that, you know, these billionaires, these sort of tech giants, think that they can just sort of shove, write a whole bunch of big checks and sort of, you know, pay some operatives to sort of do their will politically. It's not that easy. And I think that there was a little, I mean, to the extent that some of the big tech contributors gave to May Day, I think that there was some of that concern as well.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly had, you know, at least high hopes for it. I mean, and it's unfortunate.
And I think the world of
we need, you know, what we need is an Uber for campaign finance.
I think the world of Lawrence Lessig
with surge pricing,
and he was one of the people that helped me understand the problem of corruption from the beginning.
Yes.
I think he's a genius in that regard. But, you know, especially in this cycle, running, you know, this kind of political
very tough.
Is hard.
All right. There's a breaking story. We have talked about this on this program quite a bit, actually. The the Hallwell versus, well, I guess it was, what is the case? Halbig versus Burwell. Burwell being the Health and Human Services thing. Halbig was the case that wherein someone in a, and I can't remember the exact details at the moment, but someone in a state said that we should not be subject to the Obamacare exchanges, that it's not fair to give subsidies in states that have created their own exchanges, or I should say in federal exchanges, because the law says that the states have to create the exchange, not the federal government. And this was largely laughed off by a lot of people. It lost in just about every case there was. In fact, I don't think there was a circuit court split on this. So in other words, the lower courts have all dealt with this. Now, it is basically the tradition that when there is a circuit court split, like there is, in fact, on the appellate court regarding marriage equality, which we haven't gotten to, generally that's when a Supreme Court will take a case. But if there is no contention amongst the lower courts, the Supreme Court will rarely wade into it because they don't need to. Because it's largely settled, it's uncontroversial.
And in fact, it's a judicial principle that you don't weigh in unless you absolutely have to.
And however, we have a Supreme Court that has a specific political agenda. Now remember this, okay? It is patently absurd if you accept the notion, whether or not you accept the notion, that the president and the Democrats rammed through Obamacare. Okay, the Affordable Care Act. They rammed it through. It is patently absurd to believe that they contemplated there would be no subsidies, i.e. the exchanges would be impossible to work in whatever percentage of states that didn't set up their own, whether it was two states or five states or 10 states or 30 states, because the entire legislation is balanced upon this notion of exchanges and subsidies. It cannot work without it. It will completely collapse. You will get death spirals. It is impossible for it to work. It would be the height of irrationality for those people who, for anybody to have done that in any instance. There's no reasoning whatsoever. Clearly a drafting error. Depending on how you interpret that draft, frankly, because you could also interpret that draft as being exactly what the intent was. The idea that this is being taken up on what has been considered completely spurious by all of the lower courts that have heard it is a joke. But it is going to be taken up by the Roberts Court. It's hard to imagine why they would do this if they were not looking to, at the very least, in some way, debilitate the law more. I don't know why the court would do this to edify that they think the law is legal, because that's the state that it's in now. That the functioning of these, it really is a stunning development. This is going to be, man, what time is it? It's a shit show. I don't know what else to say. Got to check the time, make sure that we're outside of the FCC broadcast confines.
Oh, you could fucking curse right now.
Yes, I just did.
We're on Showtime, right?
Well, what is your response to this, Josh? I mean, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't know if you read any of the Sixth Circuit's opinion on gay marriage that's now created another circuit split that the Supreme Court is now going to have to take up gay marriage. You know, it brings me back to nominations. When I took constitutional law classes in law school, and I think I'm Matt. You're not a lawyer, are you?
Not as far as, okay. far as I know, no.
Is that?
But I will say Matt does pay for all of his Metro cards, so it's not a scofflaw.
Good. Okay. That sort of counts. is this notion that constitutional law is in part sort of a mythology? You know, that there is not sort of clear red letter law that is remains consistent. You see, even judges at the appellate court, federal appellate court judges with lifetime appointments, writing blatantly political opinions, and I think the dissent in the Sixth Circuit's
it was scathing.
Scathing. Well, part of that court, that circuit is actually pretty known well for judges that actually hate each other. So you see a lot of that language from the Sixth Circuit. But you know, you have these. You know, how is it possible that judges can write opinions like that, or can write opinions like the one on subsidies for the insurance marketplace, and send these things up to the Supreme Court? I mean, these are two guys who are writing blatantly constitutionally incorrect.
Let me just explain what you're talking about
opinions.
In terms of the Halbig.
Yeah,
Halbig was first heard by a 3-judge panel. On the D.C. Circuit Court. And this is the big court, actually, that the Republicans wanted to prevent the president from putting a full complement of judges on there, because this is the one that deals with all of a lot of the executive branch questions and administrative agency questions. And this 3-judge panel ruled 2-1, I should say, in favor of the plaintiff in this situation, saying yes, the subsidies, they should not be subjected to any of subsidies in the subjected to any subsidies in the exchanges. Well, then it went to an on bank proceeding, which is the way that these things go, where the entire 11, I don't know if it's full 11 or 10 in this instance, heard the case, and they found no, this is ridiculous. We are not here to tell Congress anything other than what you know they intended to do with this law. We can interpret this language in multiple different ways, but it's quite clear there's no way Congress would pass a law that had its own poison pill in it, because why would you do that? Why would you set up a all of everything involved in the Affordable Care Act for it to fail in the majority of states, or even a small minority of states? You wouldn't do it. And so everyone thought it was dead there. I certainly thought it was dead at that point. But I think, you know, we underestimated. And your point about constitutional law is well taken. International law is even more in that way.
Yes.
Where it's just basically like,
whatever.
It's law if we all agree it's law.
Yeah.
And if we don't agree it's law, it's not law. In this instance, we just have a smaller subset of people who are going to decide right. when it comes to the Constitution. The Constitution means X and the Constitution means Y.
Well, and I think this is why when we talk about you know, the changes to the filibuster that were made and the importance of nominations and how the Obama administration yep. really did not do all that much work you know, appointing judges on the federal court for the first part of the administration, how important that is. And we look back at the Republican effort, you know, they started a political campaign years and years ago to create
Federalist Society was built explicitly for this purpose.
Exactly, is to create this bench of politically conservative legal minds and a farm system that they could, you know, that could basically grow up to be appointed judges by Republican presidents. And I think that I don't know the exact pedigree of the appellate court judges that made these decisions, but this is what you're seeing, is these guys sort of making these decisions, and a couple of them are actually on the Supreme Court, and there really has never been. It's difficult because they don't see constitutional law as a thing; they see it as a political weapon, and I think that you're seeing the sort of the success of that years long campaign.
And to a certain extent, I think they're right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to say goodbye to freebies, even though they get a freebie Friday.
We're not going to give them that movie pick?
No. We're going to save some stuff for members, because we're going to do another 30 minutes. We got Josh Horton in studio. I'm not going to
– are
you kidding? You got to pay for that full Josh Horton experience. So we're going to say goodbye.
I'm sitting right next to the Josh Horton experience.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm gonna invoice you.
So we're going to say goodbye to freebies at this point. Don't forget, become a member of the Majority Report today, and not only will you ensure that the program continues 5 days a week, 4 days a week, whatever you listen to it, 3 days a week, 2 days a week, but you'll also get some extra time if you want it. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll put the music in afterwards. Let's just continue on. It's not even
Go ahead, Michael.
What?
Can we not waste my time?
Hold on. Wait a second. How about this? It's a little sympathy for Michael.
Well, I actually do need sympathy. I need to go to the bank again because of that situation I told you about.
Again?
Yeah. It's a little bit
You didn't go yesterday?
Of course I went. It's a process. I don't want to talk about that.
Oh, well then why did you bring it up?
Because that's why I'm trying to rush out.
Oh, that's why you're trying to rush out.
Right, among other reasons.
Mike's been having issues with his bank ever since that Nigerian prince sent him all that money.
Yeah. I'm confused.
Many years ago, it seems like.